Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and I'm joined today by a strong contingent from the East Rand, Mr. Becky Mashlobo. Becky, how are you?
I'm well, and yourself, Nick. How are you doing, Maurice?
How's Becky? How's Nick?
And of course, the other person we are joined by is the Lion of Benoni himself. I think Becky's from Boxburg. Is that right, Becky?
Please, Nick, don't slap me in with Marius, who's from Benoni, close to Boxburg. I'm from Gatley Hall.
Okay. And the Lion of Benoni, as I sometimes refer to, Mr. Marius Root. Marius, how are you?
How's it, guys? I'll reserve judgment on Becky's comments.
I think he's the only voice in the media today who's defending the honor of Benoni is Marius. So, It's a lonely role, but someone has to play it. Anyway, let us get into the news of what is afoot in the nation. And of course, we are seeing today another example of the problems caused by BEE and the government's complete obsession with racial quotas. So the Competition Commission has prohibited a proposed takeover of Burger King in South Africa. So Burger King, I think, came here a few years ago, and it hasn't established itself quite as strongly as places like McDonald's. But you're seeing a lot more of them pop up these days, so it's becoming a bigger player, I think, in our fast food industry here. So the Competition Commission said this proposed takeover of Burger King in South Africa was not allowed because it said there was a lack of historically disadvantaged persons amongst the new owners. So the company which owns Burger King, which is called Grand Parade Investments, they wanted to sell Burger King to an international private equity fund for 593 million rand to cover some of their costs. Last year, they announced they would sell Burger King and Grand Foods meat plant. Oh, sorry, my camera has just died there. Let me switch it back on. Oh, it seems to be back. Anyway. So basically, guys, let's just get into this. I think right from here, Becky, you have some thoughts on this and what it means for the economy and why it's probably not such a good idea.
Yeah, Nick, I think a good starting point would be to look at the role of the Competition Council, and it's essentially supposed to incentivize competition in South Africa. Competition is very vital and significant to an economy, enables South African consumers to have a variety of products available to them, as well as innovation. It's great for innovation, as well as the cancellation of bad innovations and whatnot. But what's particularly interesting with the Competition Council quite recently is that over the recent years is that they have sort of moved from that of incentivizing competition in the country to now being more of the arm of the states, the arm of the ANC, in a way that they are now intervening in private contracts, like this case in point, the sale of Burger King, trying to stop it, mainly due to the fact that they are afraid that they will, black individuals, particularly what they classified as economically disadvantaged people, won't have any ownership of this, is that they're essentially going beyond their mandate. And even themselves admitted that this in no way, shape, or form inhibits or competition in South Africa. So it appears to me that the value add, if I were to use the words of Gabriel Krauser of the Competition Commission Council, is rather that of zero or diminishing in the recent years. And what they don't see in this particular sale of Burger King is that these individuals that have shareholder owning of Burger King with the funds from the sale could purchase other assets in other companies. So they will have ownership in other companies. That's a point that they do not see.
Right. And it seems kind of weird to me, the idea that I just apologize. My camera seems to have stopped working, but we're just going to roll with it. It seems weird to me. So an international private equity fund, it's not exactly, you know, I wouldn't say that it has a race. It's not like a bunch of guys in a room with a, you know, big mustaches, you know, big old white men with mustaches twirling them, thinking about how they're going to oppress poor people. So it seems kind of strange to look at this, the private equity fund on the grounds of race. Maurice, what's your your thoughts on this issue?
Well, I just want to point out, one could maybe argue that the Competition Commission hasn't actually gone beyond the bounds of his mandate, because in the Competition Act, I was quickly double checked it. Purpose of the Act, it talks about, you know, ensuring competition, blah, blah, blah. And Section 1F, it says, to promote a greater spread of ownership, in particular to increase the ownership stakes of historically disadvantaged persons. So one could argue they are actually fulfilling their mandate. But like Becky says, what can is this actually going to be helping historically disadvantaged people by blocking the sale? I mean, this money that these people would have got, or whoever they might be shareholders, they would have gone and used it in other sectors of the economy. They might have gone to invest in other companies, or you know, invested in the stock market, or just in themselves, or their families, or their communities, or whatever the case might be. But now this is probably going to destroy the value of Burger King more possibly. It's obviously under pressure. It's probably, it might lead to job losses, which might have been avoided if this had been sold to this private equity company. And it's also, this is going to stop people actually, I mean, it's silly for a number of reasons. It's going to stop people wanting to invest in businesses. One of the reasons that people do invest in businesses is because you can have a possibility of selling it later on once you've built the business and it's worth something and you can, you know, make a nice profit out of it. And it's also, it's very paternalistic. You're saying, no, sorry, black people, you can't actually sell this business because you actually can't do what you want with your own property. And I understand the importance of the Competition Commission as in ensuring that there's competition in the economy and so on. I think there's a role for it from that point of view. But I definitely think it's silly that it gets involved in these things, and just shows again how, you know, race-based policy and obsession with race in South Africa leads to some perverse outcomes. And I think this is one of those examples.
Right. And you say it's going to destroy the value of Burger King. That's probably right. I mean, they already cut the price. They tried to sell it for 670 million rand. They cut the price down to 593 million. And this is probably going to drop it further, because the number of investors who can actually afford this, who have the money and have the interest, is going to be much smaller.
And just say, apparently, when it was bought in the first place, it was worth 700 million. So it obviously lost a lot of value because of COVID. But that's not only the only reason we've seen. I mean, obviously, the South African economy is not nearly as competitive as it used to be. And we see all the other problems that we have in the economy around electricity and safety and all kinds of things. So, I mean, I'd be very surprised if in 2022 this business is worth more than it is today, if it does get sold.
Right. Of course. And the other thing it's going to hurt is, you know, one of the few places that people who don't have a lot of skills have can get employment is in a place like a fast food restaurant. Mm. And as the company which owns Burger King is buckling under debt, the next step is probably, if they can't sell the thing, is going to be to liquidate some of the assets to try and cover their debts. And that'll probably mean people get laid off. So
being laid off, especially the youth. These are your entry-level jobs coming from university. A country which has like a 70% youth unemployment rate on the expanded definition, that's not good news.
Right, exactly. No,
let's be accurate, Becky. It's three quarters of people aged between 15 and 24 don't have jobs. I mean, so three in four people under the age of 24 that aren't in university or whatever are unemployed. I mean, that's like, right. I said something yesterday, that's French Revolution numbers, you know.
Yeah. No, it's absolutely crazy. And we talked about that a little bit on the show yesterday, is that unemployment has, I think, reached a new high on both the expanded definition and I'm not sure about the narrow, but possibly.
I think also the narrow definition is highest ever. No.
Any final thoughts on this, Becky?
My final thoughts on this is that what I read from this is the short-sightedness of policymakers or individuals that have or institutions that have a lot of influence on business activity in the country. I see this within parliament as well as ANC policymakers, in that the policies that they enact, policies we've seen over the recent weeks, are rather that of short-sighted, such as the one that we're currently seeing now with expropriation of property with our compensation, as well as the major one of vaccine rollout. With that of the state becoming increasingly involved in the daily lives of South African citizens as well as South African businesses with the Competition Commission Council. Now, the problem is that with the consequences of this are grave. For example, with that of the vaccine, Niels, CEO of Sibanye Stillwater, earlier this week stated that if he was allowed to purchase vaccines for his workers, he could have vaccinated 18,000 people per day. So that's how much volume could have been made, gains that could have been made if the private sector was involved in terms of the purchasing of vaccines. And I think was in terms of the Competition Commission Council, I think the actions that they've taken over recent years does more harm than good. In other words, prevents competition in South Africa, which in my conclusion, my analysis would actually say that the way in which it is acting acts counteractive to its intended objective.
Right. And that is, I think, the key point here is that something like the Competition Commission, which is supposed to foster competition, has also been given the mandate to enforce racial quotas, which does exactly the opposite of what it's supposed to do. And you see this all over government policy. Anyway, speaking of the state expanding its role into every part of our lives and businesses, I think I can't remember who said it. It might have been me. It might have been someone else on the show. But when the tobacco ban was in place, one of us said on the show that we wouldn't be surprised if there's an attempt to make some of this a little bit more permanent. And surprise, surprise, the government is putting forward a control of tobacco products and electronic delivery systems bill into law. There was some discussion about it yesterday in the media. And basically, the key things that the bill seeks to do is it will take all branding off of cigarette packaging to make them less appealing, so they'll all be plain. They will remove all designated smoking areas in restaurants. They will ban outdoor smoking in public areas. They will ban retailers from displaying cigarettes and vending machines. And for me, this is the key one, they will regulate e-cigarettes, so in other words, vapes, as tobacco products, which I think is going to have some severe consequences. Maurice, what do you make of this, and where is this coming from? Do you think this really is the sort of beginning of an attempt to ban smoking? What's your view on this, Maurice?
Well, I think it's definitely part of the government's broader move to be involved in more aspects of our lives or the economy, just as you're speaking now about the Competition Commission. And we've also seen that once get involved with the regulation of content on Netflix, for example, and Netflix has to have, you know, X amount of local content, which I mean is of course completely ridiculous. But I think with this this issue, it also seems to be if the government wants to get rid of smoking, we all know that banning stuff doesn't work, and you could actually go and you could ban cigarettes and people would still smoke. But we've also, to get people to stop smoking, this is one of the things where a lot of it comes from social pressures. I'm just looking at my own experience. Far less people smoke today than they did 20 or 30 years ago. And this is also borne out by other facts in the whole world in general. The number of people smoking has been declining. I think I'm open to correction, but I think Africa might be the only region in the world where smoking is actually on a slight increase. But apart from that, smoking is actually declining. So it comes from, you know, also social pressures, people, you know, not wanting to hang out with smokers or complaining about the, you know, smell of cigarettes or whatever the case is. And I don't know how much this would it's just another symptom of the overreach of the government, I think. You know, Nick, we obviously had this discussion before, and I was saying to you, you know, a lot of these moves to stop, make it more difficult for people to smoke, I'm not really all that against it. But I do think it's something that's, it's an overreach of the government. But they also, there seems to be a kind of there's some cognitive distance, especially in the West, it seems to be with us. Because while there seems to be a lot of moves to, say, ban cigarettes and tobacco products, at the same time, a lot of the West is moving to legalize cannabis, which is also, that's also smoking, actually. You know, especially, in Canada and places like that. And I know New Zealand, they aim to actually be, the whole island aims to be cigarette-free or tobacco-free by 2025, I think it is. So, yeah, so that's also something to watch. But also, you know, it seems to be a general move around the world where governments seem to be getting more involved in people's personal lives. And I think that was something that was just accelerated by COVID, where the government was actually telling you when you could and couldn't leave your house in lots of countries around the world.
Right. And I think one of the things I also what really concerns me about this legislation is the stuff on e-cigarettes. So I think there's still a lot of research that needs to be done on e-cigarettes and their potential health risks. But I think it's probably pretty likely, and especially based on available evidence, that e-cigarettes are not nearly as dangerous for your health as regular cigarettes. And so the government regulating them in exactly the same way as cigarettes seems to me like it's going to be counterproductive. E-cigarettes, I think, tend to be a little bit more expensive than regular cigarettes. So, you know, if you're a smoker and you've gotten onto e-cigarettes and now don't smoke tobacco anymore, if they get regulated and taxed as much as the other ones, maybe you'll just go back to regular cigarettes. Becky, your thoughts on that and this issue in general?
Just to echo your point there, Nick, is that if you regulate vapes just the same as regular cigarettes, you just simply smoke cigarettes and don't buy any, you won't purchase any vapes or anything of an alternative to tobacco products, essentially cigarettes. My overall approach to this is that, or an analysis of this, though, thinking behind this, is that you can't really put into law laws that can, in a way, significantly impact the actions of people. For example, the banning of alcohol led to the illicit market of alcohol purchases to increase. I would imagine the same would come from these increased regulations of tobacco products. People would just simply smoke cigarettes instead of vapes, or they will simply not follow them. As well as, I would think that the cost towards enforcing these regulations would be immense. In a country where we're really seeing that we don't have enough policing in certain areas. So I would imagine that the courts would actually not take up these cases themselves. They would take on more serious cases, which would be the right approach to do in this particular instance.
Right. So I think that is a good point to make, is that, you know, some of this is sort of smoke and mirrors. You know, government really can't enforce all of these laws they're putting in. But I must say, guys, there's something kind of disturbing. I mean, obviously we talk about this when we talk about EWC, but expropriation without compensation, but it really seems like since COVID began, government is trying absolutely everything it can to regulate people's lives. We're seeing an attack on property rights.
Welcome back, bro.
We're seeing an attack on property rights. We're seeing an attack on the healthcare system. We're seeing attack on people's personal lives, regulating Netflix. Am I going mad, Marius?
I don't think so.
Typing around us.
No, definitely. I mean, a lot of stuff that, you know, look out for something on the Daily Friend this weekend, written by our senior colleague, Franz Fournier, about where us at the Institute have warned about things, and then a couple of years later, they come to pass. I mean, especially with EWC and the possible custodial takings of land now, which will, you know, if it followed through to its logical conclusion, will actually end up nationalizing all land in the country. But I know this has been spoken about on the show by people who know, who are far more knowledgeable on this than me, such as Terence Corrigan and so on. But yeah, I mean, there's definitely, I don't think you are going mad, Nick. There definitely does seem like the government is trying to get, but also maybe it's a symptom because the government can't actually supply water or electricity or run hospitals or schools properly. So just keep trying to make these silly laws and makes it look like it's doing something. And as I mean, can't enforce, you know, we have the ninth highest murder rate in the world. So they can't even stop people doing something that nearly everybody agrees is a bad thing, which is murdering another human being. You know, they can't even do that. So now how are they going to enforce things such as, you know, smoking or whatever? But yeah, but perhaps maybe they will be trying to enforce those smaller laws. I mean, you know, we had, 400,000 people arrested for breaking lockdown regulations last year. I don't think we've seen one person arrested for, stealing COVID funds that, from the ANC. So, yeah, who knows? But also, I think we've also seen a lot of people have been using the evidence that there were, you know, so far fewer hospital beds when there were the alcohol bans and so on. I wouldn't be surprised if you see moves coming to also ban alcohol, at least restrict the sale of it heavily. And I think we can all agree, I definitely enjoy a beer, but alcohol also does have some social problems. But we also, at the same time, we have to treat human beings as adults, and you have to teach people about the dangers of alcohol, for example. And I think in South Africa, a lot of the problems that come with alcohol aren't necessarily to blame on alcohol. South Africa, actually, if you look at our per capita consumption of alcohol, we actually fairly low down on the on the list. You know, definitely not the lowest, but other places, you know, especially in Europe, drink far more than us, but they're far more peaceful societies. So I think there's something more, you know, but we'll definitely see, I'm sure, in the next couple of months. I wouldn't be surprised if they move to also ban things like alcohol. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if they start banning fun as well. So, you know, we'll have to keep an eye on that.
No, definitely. And I think it is very much a sort of bandage approach to governance, which is the ANC, because of ideology, can't change the basics, you know, the labor laws to make them easier to hire, the regulations on BEE to make investment easier, all these other things. And as a result, they're just resorting to taking control of more things to try and fix problems. And it's got fairly predictable results. Becky, any final thoughts on this?
It's absolute. You know, every week, every single week, there's always a new policy that just makes me to be more pessimistic about South Africa, really. I've actually spoken to you. I think I spoke to you, Nick, about this. Is that, like, this 2020 was just a trend accelerator for all bad policy in South Africa. And it's actually quite sad because I believe that currently, if you look at what's happening in the West, you know, you look at the proposed minimum global taxation rate levels across these G7 countries, in which a wealthy country will impose a particular set interest taxation rate on a corporate, and another country should follow suit so that it sort of keep taxation levels the same, so that this company does not go to another country and establish and essentially get tax incentives. That emerging markets could benefit immensely from that. And even right now, if you look at what's happening with commodities, there's increase in commodity prices. South Africa could stand to benefit from that commodity price hike. Neil also mentioned this article on Times, on the Sunday Times. And so these policies really just lead South Africa to lag behind other emerging markets. South Africa is not just one a country isolated in itself. We compete with other countries in terms of scale. So whenever we have these policies that inhibit growth, that limit growth, as well as limit labor growth, people just go elsewhere. That's why we've seen capital flight of skills, of highly skilled people going to work in other countries, especially now after 2020, where remote working is so profitable now in terms of income. You're going to see a lot of South Africans leave the country and go to other markets because they will essentially get more paid there, and there are better opportunities there. So the consequences of these policies is that South Africa will lag behind other emerging markets.
Right, exactly. Anyway, let us move on to our final story for today. So media commentator and a former colleague of ours, Gareth van Onselen, wrote quite an interesting column today, which I think expresses a sentiment that many people outside of the mainstream media have had for a while. And I'd like to get your guys' thoughts on it. So he basically starts off by saying that it must be very hard to be a political analyst outside of the DA universe, to torture reason and evidence into some patriotic narrative that smooths over the edges or cuts them right off. His idea here is that the DA has issued over the last 25 years a number of key warnings and has been one of the most prominent voices in society announcing problems with ANC governance. He points to the DA Stop Zuma campaign, which was attacked by many in the media as basically racist in 2009. And then a few years later, everyone was basically saying Stop Zuma. Helen Ziller, I think, was the first major prominent person in the country, apart from, you know, groups like the IRR, to write about state capture and cater deployment and stuff like that. And that was in 2007, and that's now, you know, commonly in the public discourse. Tony Leon wrote a book about the dangers of cater deployment in 2000. That was also, I think, at the time, I remember reading a column that one of our colleagues posted recently in our WhatsApp group, where someone said that it was McCarthyite to suggest that cater deployment would ever have a negative consequence. And basically his point in this article here is that the English-speaking media, and particularly not so much the Afrikaans-speaking media, has been unnecessarily hostile to the DA, and it's hurt them in their analysis, because the DA has often had some fairly interesting points about how South Africa was going to be affected by ANC policy. Maurice, your thoughts? Is Gareth being too hard on the media? Is he painting is he creating a straw man, or is this basically how it actually works?
No, I think Gareth's definitely makes some good points there. I mean, look, even in 2009, full disclosure, I didn't vote for the DA in 2009 because I actually also thought the campaign was a bit negative. And I could kick myself a few years later when it's like, they're 100% right. We needed to stop all the Jacob Zuma. So, but also, who knows, maybe that's could also, I mean, just my own perception, whatever at the time. But I think Gareth's definitely right. And we can just see now, I mean, you see so many prominent media personalities. I think Ferrel Huff, she's a very good example. She's, always singing the praise of the ANC, but now she's complaining about NHI. She's been complaining about lack of service delivery in Johannesburg, how the city's falling apart and so on. But you won't see her saying, it's time to vote for somebody else, and I would be very interested to know if somebody like Ferrel Huff, you going to vote for the DA in
I remember, I do speak under correction, but I believe she tweeted just after Ramaphosa's election, the ANC's done it again. And like just filled with joy because Ramaphosa had defeated Zuma.
And I think, Peter Bruce is another example. I mean, he was encouraging everybody to vote for Cyril Ramaphosa in 2019, but he's also seems to be not such a fan of the ANC at the moment. And I mean, if you look at the facts, I'm open to correction, but the top 10 or 20 best run municipalities in the country, when they do these kinds of rankings, they're all DA municipalities, and we obviously, like, the DA is obviously not immune from corruption, of course not, but the kind of things you hear in the DA are far less than the millions, it's absolutely astronomical sums that we hear that's happening. They get stolen by people in the ANC and other things that happen. I mean, we're talking about the show, the DA, they're getting being criticized for what they're doing, their policy around homeless people in Cape Town, which is all fair enough. But let's remember the Ramaphosa government, during the lockdown last year, I think at least 20 people were killed by the security forces. Let's not forget the names of people like Collins Khoza and Petros Michels, but people don't say, we need to vote these guys out to beat people to death for having a beer in their garden. But, oh, no, the DA's got a bit of a crappy homeless policy. Let's rather vote for Cyril Ramaphosa, whose police and army beat people to death. And also we get things, Chris Roper writes columns saying that Helen Sula is as big a threat to democracy as Julius Malema. I mean, this has got no basis in reality whatsoever, I don't think. And it's just kind of a knee-jerk thing because they, people who tone deaf, in inverted commas, people don't want to vote for them for whatever reason, and they'll just keep voting for more of the same, in which you've seen, which more of the same is decaying infrastructure, it's a shrinking economy, it's decaying race relations, and which is only coming from the top, I think, not from ordinary people. And yeah, we'll have to see how many people actually change their minds and decide to vote for a different party next year, especially so-called opinion leaders.
Indeed. And I think it is something that, there are many criticisms to make of the DA, and perhaps one of them is that their campaign doesn't seem to really be hammering home this point strongly enough. I think they are trying.
Exactly.
So Becky, exactly. Your final thoughts on
one of my critique of the DA is that the marketing, to be quite honest, is kind of suckish. It's not par. I went to the Western Cape for the very first time last year, and I was absolutely fascinated that in rural areas you actually have tar road. Now, this is a particular area in the Western Cape. I'm not suggesting that all areas in the Western Cape have tar roads and gravel roads and whatnot. Tar road essentially. But like, this was clearly significant to me because I mostly in my childhood grew up in the Eastern Cape. And still to this day, there's still gravel road there. If you have a small car, good luck. You need a bike to go there. So one of the major problems that I have with the DA is that the messaging honestly is not up to par, because in the height of where 1.5 million South Africans lost their jobs, they were fussing over qualification. They were falling for this media trap of qualifications. They should rather point towards the ANC's failures, literally check out this track record that Garen van Onselen did and show that this is what we have been right on for decades. We told you this will happen and it has happened. This is why the ANC today is not going to lead South Africa to high levels of economic growth and high levels of standard of living. If they use that messaging, I think they would have had a lot more supporter base than they would have currently. And even so, I don't think they should care much what they say in the media. The media does not know. I'm not being too harsh on the media, but there was an interview with John Steenhuisen and the ENCA. And this was at the time where the policy, they were choosing the policy head before Gwen Gwenya. And John, it was suggested that Gwen Gwenya would be the policy head of the DA. And the journalist stated that Gwen Gwenya does not resonate with Black people. The way she talks does not resonate with a lot of South African citizens. And that just told me everything I needed to know regarding analysts within media. They do not have an understanding of the sentiment that majority of South Africans hold in this country. So I believe the DA, if it were to work on its messaging, I believe could have a larger supporter base than it does right now.
Right. Anyway, we will see, because of course there is an election this year, assuming it doesn't get cancelled for COVID-related reasons, which I think would be a very, very bad thing for democracy in this country. But that's a discussion for another day. Anyway, we're out of time. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much for watching. We hope you enjoyed the show. And we will see you tomorrow for the Thursday edition of the Daily French Show. Cheers, everyone.